A little shakeup at the FCC ahead of this net neutrality vote. We'll talk to Ian Scherer about that. Ian's from senior editor at CNET.com, and we'll talk to him about net neutrality, the big Disney Fox ordeal today, a little bit later on the Business Lunch. But right now, I want to say hello to Ralph McLaughlin, who is the chief economist at Trulia. And Trulia is the real estate website out with their housing forecast for next year. Ralph, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thanks, Steve, and good afternoon.
Thank you for coming by. And, you know, Kim was just doing the news, and I listen to each and every story she does. Of course, I pay a lot of attention. But
you better.
Also, while she was doing that, I was at Trulia looking at houses in my neighborhood that are for sale. That's kind of how people use Trulia, right? If they're looking for a house or interested in selling their house, Trulia is one of the options available to them.
That's exactly right. We have homes available to purchase for rent. And also, if you're interested in selling, we have features that allow sellers to either sell the home themselves for sale by owner or to work with an agent. In addition to all those listings, both for sale and for rent, we also run a research page that you can be you can find it at trulia.com/trends, where we actually crunch the numbers to give insight to consumers that might help them buy, rent, or sell a home. So we're really trying to, fill the whole gambit of the home buying process.
Well, I'm interested in this report and looking at it because it looks like there's a big gap between those of us who are optimistic about home buying next year versus pessimistic kind of about home selling. They don't seem to line up.
They don't, actually. We're expecting the market to come into balance a little bit more in 2018 than it has been in the past. And while you might think that gap is something to worry about, we actually think it's good news because over the last couple of years, one of the biggest problems the housing market has been facing is low inventory. There's been solid demand,
right,
and not enough homes on the market. And, this most recent survey, we found that, optimism for home buying is starting to wane. So demand is starting to moderate a bit, and people are getting more optimistic about selling their home, which means more supply.
So we might meet a little bit more in the middle.
Yeah, we're hoping that's going to be the case. I think, inventory has been so out of whack over the past couple of years that this isn't going to, be the silver bullet. The market is not going to be perfectly in balance, but we think it's going to inch closer to balance. And that's sort of the cautiously optimistic good news that's come out of this report.
Has anything changed with the, I don't know how you would figure just with the Trump administration, because Trump's been Trump, but Trump's stock market has been Trump's stock market too. So I guess there are a lot more factors than just one to consider there.
Yeah, it's certainly a wicked problem to study. We do have sort of two findings on this. One is that last year before and after the election, we ran our consumer sentiment survey that we just talked about, and we saw that actually before the election, Democrats were very optimistic and Republicans were pessimistic, and then after the election, it completely went the opposite direction. Republicans were very optimistic and Democrats were very pessimistic. We haven't seen sentiment change that much over the past year. However, unlike the stock market and unlike the labor market, we have not really seen a Trump bump in housing. We have seen new construction actually, rise in many places, but that's about it. When it comes to price gains, when it comes to rent gains, when it comes to vacancy rates, we it's sort of more business as usual. So yes, there may be sentiment that's changed at the national level. We might like to think that the White House and the federal government has, an all-powerful hand over the housing market, but the reality is housing markets are local.
All right, I'm looking at your forecast. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Ralph, but I'm looking at the forecast, and yep. You're talking about the tax bill and how that might have perhaps negative impacts or slowing impacts on the coasts. I'm assuming that's because, in part, the state and local tax write-off that blue states would lose, predominantly blue states, and the cap on mortgage interest deductions, things like that. I live in Lake County, Illinois, which Moody Analytics just said is the number two impacted county negatively because of this tax bill, because of real estate. Having said all that, the question is, if people have more money in their pockets, they might be able to spend a little more on a house. However, the losing some of the attractive deductions could slow things down as well. How do you think the tax plan will impact the housing market next year?
overall, we really don't think there's going to be a large and measurable impact. Only about 30% of homeowners actually itemize their taxes. So 70% are going to be unaffected.
Let me say that again then, because when I saw those numbers, I thought, well, 30% of Americans, that's not many homeowners, would be bigger. But you're saying 30% of homeowners don't have the tax sort of complications where they would need to claim deductions.
Yeah, it's between about 30% and 40% on the year, but it's not much more than that when you look at homeowners. That said, it is, you know, the impact is likely to be felt in expensive counties like the one you just mentioned, Lake County in Chicago, but also very expensive coastal markets, Seattle, San Francisco, L.A., and also high tax states, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut. In those markets where property tax rates are 2.5-3%, home buyers or homeowners there are going to feel it as well as new home buyers. But in much of the country, most homeowners are really not going to feel much of an effect.
And it's really interesting to me because I just kind of assumed if you were a homeowner that you were claiming those deductions. 30-40% of us are. I did not know that. Ralph McLaughlin, the chief economist at Trulia. Great to talk to you. I hope we can do it again.
Always willing to, Steve, and thanks for having me on.
You know, I'm getting to the age where I'm starting to think about retirement. I'm hoping to do that one day. And, my idea of a great retirement would be on a day like today, December 14th, when the temperature is 18. He's already laughing. 18 degrees, the wind chills are 10. I'd like to be in Florida. Or maybe one day I could find a job where I could go to Florida for a time. Wait a minute. Bill Geiger's on a phone line. Bill, how are you?
I'm doing well, from Florida, as a matter of fact.
How's the weather there, Geiger?
I hate to tell you this, Steve, but it's 70 degrees and sunny.
I don't believe you. I think you do like to tell me that. Bill Geiger is on the phone line. Our conversations with Bill, sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. All right, so you're still working, obviously, very much employed, but that is the goal for a lot of us, to find a way to retire and go down to Florida or Arizona for the summer. Or for the winter, I should say. We're coming toward the end of the year. Maybe it's time to start thinking about plans for the new year. And I would imagine that worrying about your retirement or considering plans for your retirement is sort of a good thing to do early in next year.
Steve, it is. As a matter of fact, she's to early 60s. This is a great time of the year going into January to think about putting more concrete plans for how you're going to do this retirement thing. If you think about it, when you retire, what stops? Your paycheck stop, right?
Yeah.
It is kind of sort of like unemployment if you think about it. So think about retirement in terms of 20 to 30 years of unemployment, and you kind of have the big issue here. When you're retired, you have got to have dependable, sustainable income to replace your paycheck so you can pay your bills, so you can protect your lifestyle. And this is kind of sort of a nice time if you're in the late 50s, early 60s, to start putting together a plan for how to do that.
And, it takes some discipline, I would think, to step away from a little bit of the giddiness and do what needs to be done. Because, Bill, I'm at this stage now, at this point of the year, where I'm checking my 401k balance because it just keeps going up and up and up and up.
Right.
But that I know if you do that at the wrong time or for too long, you're going to expose yourself as well.
Yeah, the market's at 20% so this year. We're hitting new records. Everybody knows in their heart of hearts this is not going to last forever.
Right. We know in our brains, in our hearts, we're still kind of hoping, I think.
Okay, well, you know it in your brain.
We keep losing you, Bill. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can. You hear me?
Yeah, it's better now. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. If you think about this, you're at a record high in terms of your 401k. Probably is not a bad time to think about how to put together a plan so that you can have income you can count on, and also so you don't have any huge losses going forward. Because sooner or later, Steve, you know me, the higher the market goes, the more nervous I get.
Right.
And because of who we represent, we work with people who are getting close to retirement. So this is a great time of the year to do something about that, to put a plan together so you know how you're going to pay your bills in retirement.
And and it's only natural that I like to watch the market go, and I get a little giddier. But we do know that the fact that there's a winter is coming. I mean, it just happens. There will be a correction, and there will be changes in it. So let's say I'm 59, 60 years old. I've got a big bundle in my 401k. Do I keep watching it in the index funds, or are there things available to me once I reach that age to do with my 401k that might help prep me for the future?
Well, here's something a lot of people don't know, Steve. At 59 and a half, most 401k plans will allow you to do something called an in-service rollover. What that means in plain English is you can move the balance from your 401k plan into an IRA outside of your 401k plan. And there, you can start doing some really intelligent things about creating income.
And there you have more control as well.
Oh, you do. And you have control. You have a lot more options about what you can do. And we do that all the time. We sat down with a 60-year-old couple a couple weeks ago, and they rolled $800,000 from their 401k plan. And in 7 years, Steve, they're going to get between $70,000 and $75,000 a year for life. You add in their Social Security, they've got six figures that they can depend upon for the rest of their life.
That sounds nice.
You can do a lot. You can do a lot more outside your 401k plan.
Well, listen, Bill Geiger, it was nice to talk to you today. I want you to go out and collect a couple nice seashells for Bennett and me. Will you do that for us?
Well, I've got sand between my toes. It's a big problem. I don't know what to do.
Just don't start singing.
Okay.
We'll talk again soon.
Have a great day, sir.
Happy Thursday afternoon, everyone. Is it happy? I don't know. I don't know if it's happy or not. Ian Schur is on the phone line. He's a senior editor for CNET. Ian, welcome back. Man, there is a lot to talk to you about today.
There is a lot going on, absolutely.
Are we happy or are we sad?
Well, it depends on which side of the fence you are. Yeah. There was this decision made by the FCC to reverse what's called net neutrality, which, if you don't understand, us at CNET and many other publications have a lot of stories trying to explain it to you. But the big thing is that this is one of the biggest regulatory rollbacks that the Trump administration has made.
Okay, I want to read for you. I want to read a sentence, Ian, from the Washington Post story, just to sort of put this in, and then I'll set that on the table. You can explain it for me. The move to deregulate the telecom and cable industry would be a major setback for tech companies. And this is the FCC vote. Would be, it turns out it is, a major setback for tech companies, consumer groups, and Democrats who lobbied heavily against the decision. It would be a sweeping victory for Republicans who vowed to roll back the efforts of the prior administration, despite a recent survey that showed 83% of Americans, including 3 out of 4 Republicans, opposed the plan. So with all of that, the FCC did it anyway.
Right. And there's a lot of criticism toward the FCC about it, including from the tech industry. One of the things that the tech industry is really worried about, they say, is that they're worried that if we're not forced to make sure that the internet is even and equal, so that every time you log into a website, it's the same speed no matter what website you go to, then people like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and everyone else who delivers internet to you could start picking and choosing winners.
Okay,
and
so
that could, I'm in a lot of trouble.
I apologize. I'm jumpy today. So let's say Verizon. Verizon goes to Netflix, and they say to Netflix, look, we're going to give you the fastest service, faster than Hulu or whatever, and we want you to pay us this much for that. That's what they could do?
Yeah, essentially. And a lot of people would say that's free market. That's fine, right? If you want to pay more for faster service, then that should be the way it works. The problem is that it creates a situation where, especially in places like San Francisco, of all places, but also a lot of the middle of the country, there's only one or two internet service providers. And so if I don't like the business practices of Verizon or Comcast or whomever, I don't have options to go to other people. And it costs a lot of money to create competition for this stuff nowadays. And so as a result, I'm stuck with these situations where, maybe Verizon or Comcast decides they want to promote Hulu over Netflix because they're in the middle of a spat. then I lose as a consumer. And that's part of the concern that exists.
All right. I run a little teeny tiny business called SteveBertrandTravel.com. And, you know, I rely on people going to my website or searching for European travel or things like that in order to get attention at the site. Am I going to be sort of slowed down in favor of big travel companies who are going to get a deal with AT&T and such?
It's potentially possible. That's the problem, is that there have been a few examples through the years where companies have behaved badly. And they've mostly received a lot of gruff for it, and they've walked it back. So we haven't seen huge trouble with this yet. But the concern is that by opening up the opportunity for it, that they will. And by the way, this does exist in other countries. There are other countries out there where you have to pay extra to be able to access Facebook. You have to pay extra to access YouTube. That's ridiculous. And so it becomes a consumer problem, right? Which
right.
is that suddenly I'm not just deciding whether or not I want to pay for internet or how fast my internet is, but I have to decide which internet sites I want to go to. And that's just not the way the internet was designed.
Okay, so let's do this a different way then, because it seems like everything we're talking about or hearing from are people who are opposed to this idea. 83% of Americans yeah. opposed to it. There must be a case for it, too. So make that case for it. What do the supporters
Absolutely.
Say?
So the chairman of the FCC among them argues that, you know, first off, it's not the FCC's job to do this. You know, he thinks that it stifles innovation, although he hasn't actually provided any proof. And he says it stifles the growth of the internet. Again, he hasn't provided any proof. And the other thing that he has said is that it's really the FTC's, the Federal Trade Commission's job to punish companies who behave badly. So instead of forcing rules on companies beforehand, philosophically, he believes companies should be able to do whatever they want. And when they do poorly, the government should step in and stop them, not the other way around, in his view, punishing them before they do bad things.
So it's
a weird philosophical debate.
Interesting. So in a way, he's like revising the court system, if you will.
Well, no, actually, he's revising the FCC.
I know that, but I mean, I was speaking sort of generically. He's revising the policing system. It's like if someone behaves badly, yeah. this should be the cop. I'm not going to be the pre-cop before they behave badly.
Yes, he's actually abdicating some of the FCC's responsibility that it has had in theory for the last 30 some odd years, and in handing it over to another government agency. Because he believes that it shouldn't be the FCC's job.
Okay. Well, you know, there's going to be a lot more talk about that. And I appreciate you because it's one of those phrases, I think, that we hear so many times that it becomes our brains kind of numb to it. And it's difficult to understand sometimes. Okay.
Well, it's also amazing. I hear about there are people talking about it over Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners. And it's what I love about it is that people are actually waking up to the fact that this is happening and that these types of issues even exist, because a lot of people don't even understand how the internet works. And if we can all learn more about that, I'm a huge fan of that.
Let's go back to Netflix. The other big news story of the day is that Disney is buying a big chunk of Fox Century 21, I can't think of the name of it now, but the
21st Century Fox.
Thank you very much. I was trying to buy a house there. Buying a big part of their entertainment industry, including 60% of Hulu. Disney has been moving toward its own stream, taking things away from mm-hmm. Netflix. Now they own Hulu. Is there going to be a Hulu-Netflix battle with Disney having its thumb on the scale?
I think it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. You know, it's going to be also interesting to see whether the government steps in and starts to scrutinize this deal. We're talking about a $52 billion deal that's going to turn Disney into one of the largest entertainment companies ever. And what's really fascinating to me is that a lot of the nerds in my circles are super excited because Fox has the rights to make movies for X-Men and Disney has the rights to make the movies for, like, you know, Captain America and the Avengers. So now you're going to be able to actually bring them all together, and people are super excited about that. But there are...
That doesn't sound nerdy at all to me, Ian. That doesn't sound nerdy at all. No.
So there are possible negatives, right? Which is, as you pointed out, not only increased competition, but also decreased competition, right? You're going to have bigger players fighting up against each other and fewer smaller ones. And that's going to be an interesting dynamic. You know, it's it's something that the media industry has been going through a lot lately. And even, you know, we get to not only that, but corporate-wise, Comcast owns NBC. You've got a bunch of these companies now starting to buy actual entertainment companies. And so it's all just starting to become small list of players with a lot of money fighting up against each other. That, and the real question is how consumers are impacted.
That is Ian Schur. We'll wait to see how that happens, the senior editor at CNET. Ian, thanks for talking with us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much for tuning in. Hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand or on my public Facebook pages as well. Elise Glink is on a phone line from thinklink.com. Elise, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Thanks, Steve. Happy holidays.
Same to you. And you're going on a little vacation, I see. Good for you.
I am. It's been a while, almost a year. I'm ready for one.
Are you going with Janet Yellen? Because she's got some free time coming up.
You know, I called her, but she's already booked for the next year. Giving speeches and getting to hashtag the economy and all the rest.
Right. Good. Making voodoo dolls, I would imagine, things like that. So the Fed acted yesterday, right? They did pretty much what we expected. No big surprises there.
Yeah, the Fed raised its benchmark interest rate about 0.25%. They now have a target of 1.25% to 1.5%. Everybody expected that was going to be the case. And mortgage interest rates, which are based on long-term rates as opposed to the short-term federal funds rate that was moved, long-term mortgage interest rates are still sitting well below 4% right now at 3.75%.
You know, and so a year ago when the Fed started the hikes, right, it was probably about a year ago, we talked about what impact there would have on the housing market. Here we are a year later, and I don't know, how do you measure that? Has there been much of an impact?
There has been zero impact.
Yeah.
Maybe a year ago we were at 3.5% or 3.65%, and today we're around 3.74%. This is not even a 0.25% change, and it's, so I would say the effect is really negligible. And considering for the last 3 years, housing economists have been predicting that we're going to get to mortgage interest rates of 5%, it's pretty much a non-starter.
Yeah, so I was talking earlier today with the chief economist at Trulia about what they were expecting next year. Ralph McLaughlin was on the phone line, and they've got some interesting numbers where they think that the people they surveyed who were optimistic about selling a home were down, actually, and those optimistic, let me do that again, optimistic about buying a home, those numbers were down, and those optimistic about selling a home, those numbers were up. And his theory was that's kind of nice because maybe they'll meet in the middle because there's been a little too much optimism about buying and not enough houses on the market to meet that. I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I think it's going to be a very strong seller's market next year. I don't think there are nearly enough houses for people to buy. And one way to sort of judge that for yourself is to find out what the average number, the average amount of inventory is, or housing inventory sitting on the market. So the number that a lot of real estate agents look at is, if you look at everything on the market and nothing new comes on, how long would it take at the current pace of sale to sell everything that's on the market? A balanced market is when you have between 6 and 10 months of inventory. Right now we have like 3.5 to 4 months of inventory nationwide, and in some markets, like in Denver and San Francisco, it's like negative, I think. There is no inventory,
right.
Literally no inventory, and houses sell within minutes, and they close a week later.
So you're sitting at home, you're talking to your wife over dinner about selling the house, and before you know it, someone's knocking on the door to buy the house. Is that how that works?
Yeah, I think they're eavesdropping. They've got little cans, and they stand up next to your wall, and they listen in and say, oh, there's the word sell, and we have to jump in. Of course, I'm being facetious, but not that far off.
Yeah, and so you think that it's going to be nice for... buyers next year or sellers?
It's going to be terrible for buyers. It's going to be great for sellers. And ultimately, that's a problem because sellers mostly also turn into buyers. So it's a frustrating experience, except for anybody who's just selling and then they're going to go rent or live on a park bench or something.
Do you think renting is going to become the new buying in some ways? I mean, especially, I was interested. I didn't realize that I thought everyone who owned a home took deductions on their income tax. Now, McLaughlin earlier said that only 30 to 40% of homeowners actually itemize their tax return. With all of that, then, do you think renting might become a little more attractive to people?
I don't I don't think that renting should become more attractive as a long-term solution. I think renting is great if you don't know where you'd want to live, if you are changing jobs, you're young, you don't have the money to put down and buy a house. But when you look at net worth of people and what makes up the greatest part of their net worth, it's home equity. This is where Americans put their money. This is how they save for the future and for retirement. And this is, you know, one of the big benefits of the tax bill that is being taken away is the ability to, every 24 months, sell your house and keep up to $250,000 tax-free, or up to $500,000 if you're married. And so they're taking that and they're changing it from every 24 months to you now have to live in your house for 5 out of the last 8 years. And I think that's going to just have a devastating effect on the real estate market in a way that none of us understand. This is where that the law of unintended consequences is going to play big.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I always go to the salt factor, and you bring up that that turnover, which I tend to overlook. Elise Glink, great to talk to you. Have a great vacation. We'll talk to you again in the new year.
You bet. Happy New Year.